The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
If you're someone who lives in an area where it's so expensive to buy real estate and you feel like it's impossible, then I have something for you. I just released a free guide that's going to give you the 8 steps you need to take to buy your first out-of-state property. I've bought several properties out of state, living in California, investing in Ohio, and you can do the same. It's just a matter of having the right information. So click the link in the description of this episode to get your free guide today. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 178. Before we get into this episode, a couple quick announcements. If you haven't already, make sure you pause this show, leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this podcast. It'll definitely help us to reach more people and spread this message all over the world. If you do that, send me an email. My email's in the show notes, and I'll reply back and send you a free training on how to find and evaluate properties. So if you maybe are just starting out, you don't know what numbers to look at, you don't know how to figure out if it cash flows, this will definitely help you. So I look forward to hearing from you. And I actually want to shout out a review that we recently received from Reginald W. It says, I'm just getting started learning about investing and real estate once again, and listening to this podcast has helped me understand a lot more of what is being talked about. I'm not doing this review to flatter. This brother has genuinely given me more help to finally get me into educating myself before I make a move. Podcast, well done. Reginald, thank you so much. If you emailed me, I'll definitely get you that training. And if you haven't, make sure you send me an email. Also want to shout out my guy, Randy Lewis. I was in DC this past weekend for the Generational Wealth Expo. Had the opportunity to interview my brother, Henry Washington. But it was an amazing event, talking about real estate, taxes, finances, and a whole bunch of other topics. And it was just incredible. I got to meet some folks, some of you all who listen to the show. And I always appreciate meeting you all when I'm in a different city. And I thank you so much for your support. And shout out to Randy for the opportunity. It was an amazing event and looking forward to more collaboration. And I wish I had more time in DC. DC was absolutely incredible. I didn't have a bad meal the whole weekend. And it was just incredible, amazing networking. And some of the people I met, you will hear from them later this year in interviews. So shout out to Randy, and shout out to Tay Jordan. Had an opportunity to grab lunch with her. I was on her podcast for the culture a couple of years ago. So shout out to her, and thank you for taking me out and having a good time. Appreciate that. And if you have any events in your city that are around real estate, that are around generational wealth, I would love to participate. So just shoot me an email. My email's in the show notes, but I'm looking forward to more events and getting on the road, getting outside and on the ground and meeting you all in your city. So thank you all again. And this is a super important episode. This is going to be about how to avoid real estate scams. I actually brought a lawyer on who works within real estate to help us understand how to vet opportunities. When someone comes to you with a real estate opportunity, when someone wants you to be one of their investors, we talk about everything you should and should not be doing. So without further ado, let's get into this episode with Nick McGrew.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Before we get started, make sure you subscribe if you're on YouTube, like this video, share with a friend. If you're on audio, leave us a 5-star rating and review. It goes a long way. Thank you in advance. Very excited about this episode. Very important episode today. I have Nick McGrew. Nick, thank you so much, man. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. I'm pumped to be here. Real pumped to talk about what we're about to get into.
Absolutely. We got a lot to talk about, man. Lot to talk about. So, but first, just introduce yourself. Let the people know who you are and what you do, and just some background information.
All right. Yeah. So I'm Nick McGrew. I'm a lawyer and the founder of Polymath Legal. We started Polymath Legal back in 2010. And at Polymath Legal, we help real estate investors lawfully raise capital so that they can generate passive income while creating generational wealth. So we help you with the documents, the contracts, and all that stuff to get your project off the ground and hopefully make sure you're not getting in trouble as well.
Definitely. And, you know, it's actually the first time we've had a lawyer on the show. And, you know, we've talked about this. I think it's timely because there's a lot of interesting things happening out there, and people are losing their shirt, losing money and all type of stuff. And one thing I just want to say before we get into this is, before we're going to talk about a whole lot of things and help you to figure out how to vet opportunities, figure out who's legit, who's not. But the first thing I just want to emphasize is we need to stop giving people our money, investing in their opportunities just because they're black. If I present to you a real estate deal, you might trust me, you might like me, but I want you to take that to your lawyer, take that to your financial planner, to an accountant, and scrutinize it and make sure that it makes sense. You shouldn't just accept the opportunity because somebody is black. So that's going to be part of what we talk about today. What are your thoughts on that?
I was about to say, I'm going to piggyback off of that and take it the further step. And also, you shouldn't be presenting deals to somebody unless you've had, if you vetted it and you've had your attorneys look through it and you know you're doing it the proper way as well. Because it's a two-way thing. And obviously, we want to make sure that the investor is protected. But one way to do that also is to make sure that the person that's running the deal is educated and doing it the right way as well.
Definitely. So I'd say the most common that I, at least that I see, type of investments people do, you have like crowdfunding. You might invest in somebody's crowdfund, you might invest in somebody's fix and flip, maybe even in some buy and hold opportunities or syndication. So at a basic level, like, let's say you're the investor and you're the person with the deal. Mm-hmm. I am somebody you're coming to for money to invest in your opportunity. What is some paperwork that I should be expecting from you?
Yeah. So one, it should be a lot, and it should probably actually be scary. And, you know, I have clients a lot of times when I do the documents, they're like, my investors are going to be afraid of this. And I say, great. You know, part of what we're trying to do, at least for me, from the issuer side, the one who's doing the deal, is we want to tell them all those things that are going to be scary so that they can know that before we have their money. Because, you know, obviously my clients, like, we want to raise the money, we need the money. But I say, look, you'd rather not have their money and them get scared away now versus us be quiet about something that could potentially happen, and then that bad thing happens and now you have their money. They're going to be, you know, probably suing you and taking all your time and resources away from your actual deal. So for an investor, some of the things you should be looking at, part of it just depends on how the deal is structured. Mm-hmm. At a very minimum, if it is a debt type deal to where they're guaranteeing the money to you, and we can talk about guaranteeing in a second too. But with that, you should have at least a promissory note and probably a loan agreement that talks about, gets into the details of the terms and what happens if they pay late or don't pay. And, you know, as it's secured, can you put a lien on a property for that sort of stuff. If we're looking at a bigger deal where we have lots of investors, you're probably going to have a PPM, which is that big, long, scary disclosure document I talked about. Yeah. That is supposed to be, it's kind of a combination of the business plan, talking about the executives, and then the important part, like I said before, talking about risk factors. So all of those things that could go wrong. And now in there, we might be talking about the things we're going to do to mitigate that and what we're going to do if those things do potentially go wrong. But we are making sure that we say, hey, here's some things that can go wrong. For instance, you could lose all of your money. That's the one that my clients kind of push back on me. I'm like, nope, not taking it out because it's the truth. And so we want people to know that even if we guarantee something, which you shouldn't be doing that, but if you do, or if you're getting into this, you could lose all your money. And so that's something to understand. And so with that, I also would say is you don't want to invest money that you can't bear to lose as well.
Yeah, I think this is very important. And something else that I've seen is like people spending their last, like, it's well-intended. And I think a lot of it is people are naive, and you just think, like, you see this person on, whether it's like this show or some other show, and you're like, all right, let me just send them the money and they could do something with it and flip it. But it's like, no, that's not what you should do, especially if you cannot lose the money. And I think mm-hmm. that could be part of why there's so much angst and anger, because a lot of people are giving their lives, which is not a wise thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I tell my clients when they're, sometimes I can get a vibe. I'm like, this person should not invest. They're technically qualified to invest, but from the questions they're asking and things like that, I'm like, they're going to be hurting if this goes bad. And so I'll tell my client, you should think strongly about taking that money, because it does nobody any good to have an investor that's struggling, or have that investor that maybe thought it was a 3-year hold and the market's different. So now it's a 4 or 5 year hold and now they're calling you all the time. And again, now you're diverting your time and resources to managing that investor instead of working on the deal and try to mitigating those market factors or whatever you're dealing with.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. One thing that comes to mind is like flipping. Like the market has just changed tremendously over the last couple of years, and some flippers are being impacted. And obviously flippers tend to raise money from other people, private money, whatever. So if someone has come to me with a flip deal and saying, hey, you know, you give me X, let's call it $10,000. You'll get X, you know, after we flip it within this time period. So you mentioned like a promissory note. Is there... And you mentioned like a lien, like potentially putting a lien on a property. If I'm contributing money, should I try to get a lien position, like a second lien or something like that? Or what would you recommend?
Yeah, that's the few times that I've invested in like a new construction or a flip, and it's a debt position. We have a lien on the property. Granted, yeah. We're like probably second or third. We're not the top lien, but nonetheless, if things go bad and, you know, the 1 and 2 foreclose and there's still money left, we're at least going to get something. Whereas if we didn't have that lien, it might be a little bit harder for us to potentially collect on that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you explain, like, for those who may not know, like what that means, like to get like a, well, I guess what a lien is and then just like position and what that means too.
Okay, yeah. So when you have a property, there's one of the things you do when you're buying a property, at least should do, is a title search. And so on there, you can basically see who all has any interest in the property. So you're almost always going to see a mortgage, assuming that there's a mortgage on the property. Sometimes you might see tax liens if people haven't paid taxes. You might see a mechanics lien if they got some renovations done and didn't pay the contractors yet. And so you can look that up and see who all is claiming an interest on this property. And so with a promissory note, and assuming they're giving us permission to lien on the property, I record that so that when somebody's looking at that property, they'll see, you know, the mortgage and the mechanics lien, and then they'll see Nick McGrew's promissory note after that, so that again they know that I'm claiming an interest in this property, or I have a debt that's secured to this property.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense. So the majority of the audience is probably doing deals on like a smaller scale, single family, smaller multifamily, maybe like a flip here and there or something like that. So far, paperwork wise, seems like promissory note is important. Potentially like getting a lien position is important. Is there any other paperwork people should be expecting or looking out for when they're considering investing in certain opportunities?
So this is not so much a legal thing, but I would say, let me see your underwriting. Let me see your pro formas, your financial analysis and your stress test. Because again, things don't always go well. You know, I have clients that are very, very, very seasoned, and they still have deals that do not go how they want to. And so part of what I'm looking at when I'm looking at those that financial analysis is, one, we're trying to guess how this property is going to do in the future. And so we're making a lot of assumptions. And so I want to look at, what assumptions are you making? Are these reasonable assumptions, or are you assuming that the absolute perfect scenario is going to take place? Because if that's what we got to do for me to get a return, I don't want to invest in that, just because it would be great if the absolute perfect scenario happens. But in reality, that doesn't happen all the time. And so I'd want to see, you know, what assumptions are you making? Are you taking into account like the best scenario, maybe what you think is likely to happen, and also the worst case scenario? And I want to see, in the worst case scenario, what am I looking like? Am I at least getting my money back? Are my returns going to be lower, or am I potentially losing money? And obviously the worst case scenario is we're losing money, but we can kind of figure out, you know, what is the worst likely scenario. And so I'd want to look at all that stuff so I can again assess this and see, is this a risk that I'm willing to put my money into and to take on?
Got it. So it sounds like we should be like ideally the person raising the money should be able to provide all those three scenarios. What if things go extremely well? What if things go okay? And what's the conservative side, or if just doesn't really go well, just so that the person investing can see, all right, to your point, will I be okay? Am I okay with each of these outcomes, either of these outcomes. Does that sound right?
Yeah. And part of what I'm doing with that too, though, is I'm seeing, have they done their homework? Because if I say, can I see your financial underwriting? They're like, oh, I don't have it. So then I'm in my mind, I'm like, okay, so what makes you think this is actually good other than it looks cool? And, you know, you've seen other people be successful in a similar type of deal, but every deal is different. So these types of things also just indicate to me how legit is not the right word, but kind of how responsible are you being in getting into this deal? How much are you trying to look forward and see and protect against the risks that are really there?
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that's helpful in the vetting process, because I mean, if someone presents an opportunity, let's say you're like a new investor, this is like your first time investing with somebody else, if they can't produce that, maybe that's just, all right, well, maybe I'm not going to participate in this, because you clearly haven't done your homework to figure out, well, how are we actually going to make this money? Like, what are all the expenses and estimates and stuff like that? So I think it's important for people to know, like, you know, and to ask that question. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Great. So the next thing I want to talk about is syndications. So syndications, we've had like a variety of people come on the show who have groups and syndications and things of that nature. And one of the things that I think is important is like transparency, especially because syndications is like within our community, it's not really something many of us have had exposure to. It's very new for a lot of us. So I'm glad we were able to have people to be able to speak to that. For somebody who's like brand new to investing, would you recommend starting on the syndication level or doing something smaller? What's your take on that?
So I'll give the caveat. This is not even a legal opinion. This is just more of a personal opinion. Yeah. But I like syndication. One, it's more of what my clients are doing, so I'm just around it a lot more. But I also like it more because, you know, I've talked about before how things don't go perfect. Well, with syndication, you obviously, there's more things going happening, so there's a lot more opportunity for things to go wrong, but you also have a lot more opportunity to kind of save those things that are going wrong. Because if I have a fourplex and one tenant's gone, now 25% of my rent is gone, for at least for the month or two or until I get re-rented. If I've got a 400 unit apartment building, if one person's gone, that's not really going to be meaningful at all to the bottom line. And so you've got a little bit more wiggle room or just ways to kind of correct things when they're going wrong. But with that also, you are taking on more risk just because you got 400 people instead of four people coming to the building. So that's 400 sinks, 400 toilets, 400 guests that are, you know, going to mess up whatever. So there is more risk into it, but I think that it allows for a lot more wiggle room and maneuvering when those kind of negative things might occur on the property.
Definitely. That makes sense. And for those who maybe are not so familiar with the terminology, can you at a basic level explain like what the setup of a syndication is?
Yeah. So syndication, if we think about, you know, group economics, that's group economics on steroids. I say I want to buy or build an apartment building. It's going to cost me $50 million. I don't have that. With syndication, I don't need that, because essentially I can raise that capital. And now we often would call me, if I'm the one running the deal in the industry, we call me the GP or the manager. And then you would be the passive investor, so the LP or the limited partner. And so with that, I can raise the capital from the limited partners. They're typically going to bring the most or all of the money, but I'm bringing the sweat equity. So I'm going to split those profits with you, and I'll tell you in advance how we're going to split it. And as I do the work and the property starts bringing in money, when I say, hey, we're doing well, we paid all of our expenses, we've got some extra cash, let's spread this out to the owners, I'll split some of it with the investors, and I'll take some for myself or my management team as well. And so we're all growing with that property as it hopefully performs how we're planning to. So yeah, it's basically just pulling all of our capital together. And so the cool thing that I like about syndication is that I work in it typically in the context of real estate, but it really can be used in almost anything you're trying to raise capital for and group money together, you could do that. So you know, on higher levels, even banks, when you have like a $1 billion development, banks are actually syndicating the financing of that. You know, one bank might say I've got 100 million, another one might say I've got 500, I've got 300, and they're coming together to put that loan together for the developer, but they're syndicating the money to bring that loan together. Even basketball teams can be bought with syndication. The first syndication that I did was for a movie. So somebody had a script and they said, hey, I need 800 grand to make this movie. And so we set up a syndication there. So I like syndication just because I think, or I hear about it and work about it in the context of real estate, but really whatever project you have, syndication can be a way to get the capital that you need for it.
That's so crazy. I didn't even think about it in the context of anything else besides like real estate, but it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Like I think with the Hornets, it's like a group that's purchasing Michael Jordan's stake. It's not just one person. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on something else that I've seen that people have had challenges with is investing with people who don't have any skin in the game. So they don't have a cent of their own money into the deal. What do you think about that? What's your take on that generally?
I think it would depend on the size of the deal. Mm-hmm. 'Cause with syndication, it's kind of common. A lot of times the management team might invest a little bit alongside their investors, but it's not uncommon for them to not invest. But what they are doing is they're probably giving the personal guarantee on the loan. 'Cause typically with syndication, you're not syndicating the whole, whole purchase. You're syndicating the equity piece that you can't get a loan on. And so the management team, one, they're staking their reputation. They are typically giving a personal guarantee on the loan. And a lot of times they will invest, but if they don't for like a larger syndication, that wouldn't be a big red flag for me. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking about, like a fourplex or a flip or something like that, that'd be something where I'd say, hey, you need to get in this as well. 'Cause again, it's smaller. So if things go wrong, there's less maneuverability. So that would, for my personal investing. So yeah, a smaller deal, I'd want you to definitely be in, but a larger deal, it wouldn't be deal breaker for me.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you mentioned on the syndication side, the fact that if someone is not maybe contributing financially, they have something on the line, reputation or personally guaranteeing the loan, so if something goes wrong, I mean, it is kind of a ding for them, which wouldn't be great. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it, especially for somebody who maybe this is like your first deal, which is probably gonna be like on a smaller scale, like maybe small multifamily or single family or flip or something, probably gives you a bit more peace of mind knowing that somebody is at least contributing something to it. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, if it all goes bad, you're not the only one losing. If that makes sense, especially if they're the one raising it and things like that. And it's my personal opinion too.
Yeah, and particularly again, if you don't have any say about those things going bad decisions that brought you there too.
Definitely. So how do you recommend people vet the individual who is like, raising the money for a real estate deal? How do people know who they should trust? Like what type of questions should they ask just about them in general, even outside of the deal, to make sure like, hey, is this somebody who I really can trust, who I want to give my money to and believe in what they're presenting? What's your recommendation about that? And just trying to discern if it's a good person.
Yeah. So one, talk with them, call them and kind of see, how responsive are they? Because if they're not very responsive when they don't have your money, they're probably not going to change that. So that's going to be the first one, is that, as I'm vetting them, I want to know how responsive they are, because if I can't get a hold of them to ask them my questions now, I don't want to be in a situation where they have my money and I can't get a hold of them. Yeah. So that's one thing that you can do. Another thing is I would ask them, what are the past deals they've done? So I want to look at their track record and see what have they been successful in? What are some deals also that didn't go well? And what did you do to course correct, or how did you remedy that? I would also probably ask them if I could contact some of their past investors. And I'd kind of ask those investors the same thing. Were they responsive? Were there deals that went bad? Did they communicate clearly and transparently? Another thing, if it is a syndication, now there's lots of different, so with syndication, you're selling a security. And so there's lots of exemptions from security registration. One of the big ones in real estate though is called Regulation D. Mm-hmm. And so with that one, you don't have to do a whole full-on registration like a public company, but there are some things you have to file. And one of them is called Form D, which is basically just information. So it says who the issuer is, how much they're raising, how much of the raise are they taking for themselves? Because a lot of times those issuers will take fees. And so it has kind of just that general information. And so I would look, and that's available publicly. So the SEC has a database called EDGAR, and you can look at the Form Ds on there. So if somebody's coming to me with a syndication and they're saying, yeah, we're doing a Reg D exemption, I'm going to look up their Form D, because this again is another thing that indicates to me, are they crossing their T's and dotting their I's, because a lot of people don't do that. And so they say, hey, yeah, I've got a syndication, we're doing Reg D. And I say, great, send me your stuff and I'll kind of look into it. As I'm looking into it, if I see that they haven't filed the Form D, I'm probably not going to invest with them, or at the very least, I'm going to ask them and say, hey, when are you planning to file that? Have you started raising capital yet? What's going on with that? And if they're like, what do you mean Form D? Then to me, I'm going to say, yeah, I'm not going to go there. Because that's something that you're required to do. And again, it shows me that maybe you don't necessarily know all the things you're supposed to be doing and all the regulations and hoops that you should be jumping through. And so I don't want my money tied up in a litigation because another investor is upset that you didn't do something right. And so that's another thing that you can do to vet some of them as well.
Definitely. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of times people get so anxious and they feel like they're missing out. So like I was talking to somebody the other day and they basically told me like, hey, I'm desperate. I want to invest. Like I'm desperate. And it's like, you shouldn't be investing a cent if you're desperate. That's the completely wrong thing to do. And with desperation, you're not going to do that due diligence. With desperation, you're just going to hand your money over and hope it works out. And there's plenty of people who will take your money and who knows what will happen with it. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really glad you mentioned just like calling the person, just trying to understand what they've done, look at their past deals and things of that nature. And I mean, if someone's not willing to, one, communicate with somebody who's giving them money or be transparent about past deals and things of that nature, you should run fast as you can, in my opinion.
Yeah, you hit on a good thing. People get investment FOMO. And I'm like, just take that FOMO and keep your money, though. Like, feel the FOMO, but keep your money and say, look, let me look at this deal and watch this deal so that when the next one comes, I'll have a little bit more information and maybe I'll be ready for that one. But yeah, there's no need to rush. Obviously, we say, you know, the sooner you start investing, the better. But it's not helpful for you to invest early into something that's really bad that you haven't vetted. So
yeah, I agree. Like the FOMO, it's almost the same thing with the stocks. Like all these stocks, you know, market's been crazy over the last couple of years, but all these like meme stocks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like people feel like if you're not doing it, you're like, I mean, if everyone is doing something all at the same time, one, it's probably too late. Mm-hmm. And two, you probably should be doing something the complete opposite. Yep. So, you know, that's just, it is what it is. Yeah. Yeah, but I think, you know, that vetting piece is so important. And for you have mentioned the performers and just like the financial projections and things like that. If somebody doesn't really know how to interpret that stuff, do you recommend they go to like a financial planner or somebody like that who could help them maybe interpret it and try to understand it a little bit better?
Yeah, definitely get somebody who is an expert or knows that stuff that you trust and have them explain it to you. Yeah. And there are, you know, not that you want to just go out and do stuff without the full education, but there is a lot of actually good information on the internet about just pro formas and analyzing them. And so that can be one place that you start. Yeah. And then as you're looking at it, you get stuck, talk to your expert and have them kind of explain it to you so that you can also start learning how to vet those and understand them yourselves as well.
Definitely. So I want to get on the other side. So the side of now I'm the investor. I'm the one raising the money for like a flip or a syndication, or you know, maybe I'm seeking partners to do a buy and hold for like a 4-unit property or something. What should I be doing? Like if I come to you and I want you to help me put stuff together, like what do you need from me and what do I need to make sure I'm doing while I'm raising the money, like during the process of the flip or acquiring the property and after?
Yeah. So one of the kind of couple of the first questions I'm going to ask you is, one, how much money are you trying to raise? How many investors do you think that you'll have, and kind of what is the financial picture of those potential investors? Because that, as I was mentioned before, this is a big generalization, but oftentimes if you have a passive investor, you're selling a security. And so if you're selling a security, you either have to register that security or have an exemption from registration. And so we help clients find those exemptions because registration is public companies, very expensive, very long process. And in real estate, you're not going to have that kind of timeline. And so when I'm asking, you know, how many investors do you think you'll have? What does their financial picture look like? How much money are you trying to raise? Those are questions that are going to help me understand which exemptions might apply apply to you. And then from there, we're going to see, okay, we may have three or four exemptions that could work for you. Now, which one's going to be the best one? And so, yeah, understanding who your investor or potential investors look like, who they're going to be, that's something you're going to want to have up front pretty early.
Definitely, definitely. So let's say, you know, I think I'm going to have five investors. I'm estimating $8,000 to $10,000 a piece. And so that's about $50,000. I'm going to buy a property for, and as I'm going, this is like the level of detail you would prefer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I'm going to buy a house for $30,000. We are going to put $50,000 into it. So we're going to be all in $80,000, and I'm estimating it'll appraise at $160,000, and we'll have whatever X, Y, and Z profits. Would that be like sufficient for you, or would you want more information on the financial side?
That would work to start out. Before we close, we probably would want to have things ironed up a little bit more, but that's enough to get us started. Yeah. Next thing I'd ask is, how long are you planning to hold this? Because again, the timing also can determine different things as
Six
well.
6 months.
6 months, that makes it easy actually. So a lot of times a promissory note that is under 9 months is just deemed to not be a security. Yeah. So I'd say we're probably a lot easier compliance there and can do promissory notes and kind of be done in most cases.
Definitely, definitely. So you're in a very unique position because you, I'm sure, are privy to a whole lot of deals and clients and people in your network and things like that. And you alluded to a couple of times, like just opportunities you've invested in. So can you talk a bit more about that and just like different opportunities and real estate deals that you've been able to invest in?
Yeah, I do get to see a lot of deals, but it also still is like a small amount. Like it's my little world. It feels like a lot of deals, but there's tons more that are going out. But at least in my little world, I can see, you know, the deals and kind of what the market for my little area is. And so, yeah, it's interesting because sometimes I'll have a client that might have a deal in their terms, and I'm like, have you talked with investors about that? And they're like, why? And I'm like, well, just because there's a lot of opportunities that are far better than what you're offering right now. And it's fine if your investors don't have that and your investors are cool with that, then that's great. But you just might want to look at that. So yeah, it is kind of, I am in a unique position to see a lot of deals. Haven't done anything too crazy. A lot of it is just kind of a large multifamily. Mm-hmm. One that I'd say would be crazier, which is not even that crazy. It was a new construction spec home build.
Oh, snap.
And so it ended up, so actually this is a good example of understanding your who you're investing in. So the deal was supposed to, I think we were supposed to almost get like just under 2x in about 18 months because there's brand new construction. So you're literally building all the value there, and there's a luxury home. And so it was looking pretty good. The construction team, they've done this a lot, and they had showed us two or three that they had just sold in the past. So I was like, okay, looks like you know what you're doing. Looks like this model is working. And things were going well. I ran into them at a conference. They're like, hey, we're probably going to be selling it and finishing up in like the next 3 months. Things are looking great. We're good to go. And even a month before, okay, cool. We're about to sell. Things are looking great. And then when it comes time to actually close, they're like, so actually, things ended up kind of not going so well. We didn't lose money, but it was going to be like a 2% return, basically a bank return, essentially.
Oh, snap.
And so we were like, what's going on? What happened? And so they kind of got, they were very truthful and candid. They said, yeah, you know, we kind of got just a little loose. We were towards the end, and they had pre-sold the home. And so the homeowner would come in when they're working and say, hey, you know what, change these or put in this thing or add this material here. And so because their numbers were looking so good, they're like, oh yeah, this change here is not going to, you know, $1,000 here is not going to change anything. This little bit here is not going to change anything. But in that last month, they ended up doing that so much that it just dramatically took the returns down.
Wow.
But when I talk about knowing your who you're investing in, because we had an agreement that we had a certain split that we were going to do. And we basically were like, look, you guys dropped the ball. What are you going to do here? We're the investors. You guys were making all these decisions. And if you're going to tell us that we're going to split it like normal, that's great. But just know we're not coming back. And so they ended up basically giving us all as a group of, there's like maybe eight of us that invested in this, and they give all the returns to us. So they didn't split it, take any for themselves.
Wow.
And so they did basically built a home for free,
wow.
but gave us the returns. The return ended up being okay. But that's an example of understanding who you're investing in, because that builder, they knew that, hey, if I don't give them something decent now, they're never coming back. Whereas now I would be interested in looking at future deals with him, just because I know that he's looking out for me and trying to do the best. And when things don't go quite well, he's going to do what I would want done to mitigate that damage there.
I love that. And I think it's important to speak up when things don't go well, because sometimes they may not. Like previously mm-hmm. we were talking about, you know, there should be paperwork just documenting what's the worst case scenario and all those things. Like, what if everything fails or doesn't turn out as projected? You mentioned the 2x and you didn't end up getting that. But the good thing about the person you were investing with is that they were transparent with. They were transparent. And to your point, they thought ahead, like, hey, and I think it's great that you're even saying you'd be open to doing another deal with them, because they had integrity
mm-hmm.
and they actually, mm-hmm. you know, hey, this is why it happened. This is exactly what happened. And they didn't just like duck and try to run away. And, you know, you end up in litigation and all this type of stuff. And I think it's important,
because
not everybody does that. Some people just want to like blame the person who invested with them or blame different stuff and just not take responsibility for the part of it that was in their control and that they messed up at. And it's okay. Like sometimes you mess up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes like you miscalculate, or you could do all your homework you want. It just doesn't work out. But hey, I mean, if you think long term, you know, you never know. You could always do another deal and people will trust you because you were able to stand up and say, hey, like we just messed up. So I'm glad, you know, that you had that experience.
Yeah. 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 I think it's just, yeah, we use the word integrity. Like that meant a lot to me, because, yeah, like you said, things are going to mess up.
Yeah.
The best laid plans can go wrong. And, you know, again, there may have been some things they could have done to alleviate this, but nonetheless, they're going to take the lesson now because they built a home for free. But also, they also got some investors that say, you know what, I know they're looking out for me. And so if there's a good deal that comes along, I'm going to look into it and see if it makes sense for me to invest in.
Definitely, definitely. Were there any other deals you invested in that didn't go as planned?
No, I'm relatively new to the investing in the last 5 to 8 years, and the market's just been good. So like, kind of as you're saying, this is a timely topic of us talking about vetting investors, because what I've been saying the last probably like year and a half, I'm like, now we're going to start seeing who actually is good at real estate. Because before, you could just be bad at it with like in the investor space, you could be bad at it, but the market's just going to take you up regardless. Kind of like how housing was back in like 2006, 2008. Again, you could buy something and it's just going to increase regardless of what you did. Now we have lending's a little bit tougher. The market's not climbing as quickly as it was. And so we'll start to see who actually is good at real estate. But yeah, thankfully, just because I think it's just the market timing more than anything, they all have just done well, thankfully.
Yeah. Has it mostly been syndications?
Yeah, mostly okay. syndication.
Yeah. Cool, cool. Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that though, because I don't think it's a coincidence that so much is happening right now. To your point, like a lot of people have been riding the wave. Same thing with stocks, like people riding the wave, but no one, like we'll be able to see over the next couple of years who can go through this storm or whatever you want to call it, and all these different market conditions. You know, I think people should be slower to invest their money with the individual. Like I really think the best teacher is trying something yourself. For the first time, you know, you can get some help or some coaching or mentorship or something like that. But I think there's value in putting your own money up, you know, so you can see how it feels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe one day you want to be the person raising the money, but at least you've put your money out before, you know, you've dealt with various things before. And so, you know, you'll have knowledge, you'll have more experience for when it's time for you to maybe bring money in or for you to put money out into somebody else's opportunity. So I think there's a lot of value in that personally. And I mean, hey, if you could manage decently these days, I mean, who knows what, you know, what the future is going to look like, but I think there's a lot of value in it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, it's a weird balance, because on one hand I say, you know, get educated, but on the other hand I also say don't sit back forever. And so again, I'm not telling somebody to jump into a bad deal, but at the same time, no deal is going to be perfect.
Yep.
And not going to go exactly right. And so you know, getting that experience, because even if the deal goes wrong, you can start learning, okay, here's some indicators of when that deal is going wrong. Even with the example that I just talked about, one of the things that I learned about now is, even in the last 2 months, I'm going to still make sure I'm contacting the person I'm investing in to make sure that we're on track and everything, even if things were going great the whole time and we're about to wrap up. So even when you have a loss, and again, this gets back to not investing that money that you can't afford to lose, because even when you have a loss with an investment, typically there's also a lesson there too. So it's not a complete loss.
Definitely. No, I agree. I agree 100%. How often do you check in? Like, if you're investing with somebody at like the different stages, do you have like a cadence? Like, do you check in like every month or every other month or so, just like how things are going? How do you usually do it personally, or and what do you recommend?
Have a cadence, whatever it's going to be, periodically. Yeah. If we're talking about the syndication and bigger projects, in my opinion, a good issuer is going to give at least a quarterly update anyway, whether there's nothing going on or great things going on or bad things going on. There's going to keep you updated so that, and at a regular cadence, so that you just know generally what's going on. And so with those ones, I just kind of wait for the newsletter. If there's something that gives me question or pause, I might reach out to them. But typically I also know that we're in it for like a 3 to 5 years. So even if something's going bad right now, that's right now. Now, if I get three more quarterly newsletters where it's going bad, that's when I'll have an issue. But you know, everything's not going to be perfect all the time.
Yeah. No, it definitely makes a lot of sense. I do want to switch gears a little bit, Nick, and talk about your journey. You know, we were talking and you mentioned you've had your own firm for about 13 years now, right? Mm-hmm. Roughly 13 years now. So just talk to us about that and just like why you decided to go out on your own and just like the specialties at your firm, how those things develop. Because, I mean, we don't really see a lot of Black businesses lasting that long. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but a lot of businesses go out of business pretty quickly, like a year or two or something like that. So would love to hear just more about that.
Yeah. So it was always a plan, but it did not go at all how I had planned it. Yeah. So I graduated law school in 2009. So the economy's kind of tanking then. And so typically in law school, your first summer, you often work for free. Your second summer, you work and you get paid. And that summer is kind of like a long interview to have them offer you a job when you graduate. And so I did that and was working at a in-house at a company. And they said, yeah, we love you. You're great. We'd love to have you come back. We'll, you know, touch bases more in the wintertime to really see what it looks like. And basically, this is a side note to that. Actually, I remember I made a good amount of money that summer and I was living with my sister. So I just pocketed all of it. And so I was like, let me be responsible, invest in the stock market. And so I invested like $10,000 and literally like a month later, it was like $3,000 because the market had just, and these were like blue chip, like stocks supposedly. But that's an aside. So anyway, but that kind of shows what was going on in the economy. So I stopped working there. A month later, economy's tanking. And so when winter comes, they said, oh yeah, you know, the business had to reorganize and our office isn't going to be here and we're all getting split up. Some of us are getting laid off or let go. So sorry, basically. And so I was like, great. Well, I'm graduating and I guess I got to figure out what I'm going to do now. And so it had been my plan to, you know, work at a firm or business 2 or 3 years and then start my own. That's what I wanted to do. So I graduated, didn't have a job. I'm applying for jobs that I didn't really want. I'm competing with lawyers that were 2 or 3 years senior because they had also gotten laid off because of the economy. And just, yeah, I wasn't really happy with that. I lucked out kind of temporarily. A friend of mine in law school, they needed her tax consulting firm needed some help. So I was doing that kind of on a project basis. I might work like maybe a week a month, but at least kept me fed and things like that. And I remember during all that time, I was like, okay, well, I'm at home all day, so I'm not going to just sit here. I'm going to be, you know, building into myself. So I was, you know, building a business plan for the firm. I was reading practice guides, just kind of learning more about the practice of law, kind of just getting ready for whenever that time might come. And so I had a project I worked with them in New York. I ended up being there for about a month and it's great. They like, I lived at the W in Midtown for a month. And it's sweet too. Like I had a bedroom, a living room, like it was dope. Sheesh. So they paid me well. I was living it up and I'm like, this is great. But I saw, you know, how much they were paying for me to stay there, how much they're paying me versus how much the company itself actually made. And I just like, man, they weren't even here and they're making way more than I thought I was getting broke off, but I'm getting pennies compared to what they're getting. And so that's kind of what motivated me. I was like, you know what? Time to launch the website. We just got to do this. Because again, it'd been about a year and a half, and I've been applying to these jobs that I didn't want. And I was like, you know what? I need to try to bet on myself instead of betting on trying to get this job that I'm not really wanting anyway. So I lucked out, got blessed, whatever you want to call it, because one of my good friends was a property manager. And I think I like launched the website on a Monday. She calls me up on Wednesday and says, hey, you do real estate, right? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, great. We just fired our attorney. So I want to bring you in to my boss and, you know, see if we can have you come on. So it was a family-owned real estate company. It's two brothers. They had a lighting company, and they basically had contracts with all the hotels and casinos in Vegas for lights. So Think of all the lights there.
Yeah.
So one brother ran the light part, and then another brother took that money and invested into real estate. And so I got that client. It was my first client. That client is what kept me fed for, you know, the first year or two while I'm building out my client base. And then it slowly grew from there. But yeah, it was... People ask, you know, would you do it again or what do you recommend? And I'm like looking at it now, I'm like, oh yeah, because I've landed well now, but it took a long time to get there. And so kind of to your point, talking about how a lot of businesses fail, I still am a firm believer, and a lot of people have said this too. I think it's just the businesses fail because you stop. If you just keep, because you're going to get those hard times and those things where you feel in your gut that you should stop. The businesses that succeed are the ones where they push through those moments where you're feeling like you should stop. Because yeah, there was many times where I'm, you know, checking the mailbox like every couple hours because I got rent due in 2 or 3 days and I'm waiting for some checks for clients. And if those don't come through, I'm not going to be able to make it. So times like that to where, you know, I was talking with somebody the other day. I was like, you know, when I started out, it's interesting how much it's changed, because at first I was trying to see, you know, can I feed myself? And now I've got like 4 or 5 employees. And so I was like, it's weird. I still have the stress. I'm like, oh, I got to make payroll. And it's not that it's an issue, but it's like, cool. Now I'm like, not only can I feed myself and my wife, but now I'm like, can I feed these other 5 families, which is kind of cool. And, you know, if you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have never thought something like that was going to be happening.
Definitely, man. That's amazing. It definitely sounds like it was a turning point around the time when the job didn't work out and you just had to figure it out. And it sounds like that experience in New York, it was a turning point for sure. Cause you're like, wait a minute, if they could do all this and give me this, like, what could I do if I just take a chance and try to figure it out on my own? So, you know, I think that's incredible. And you did talk about some of those hard times. I would love to hear some more of that. Cause you mentioned sometimes just like, you know, hoping client checks come in so you can pay your bills and do what you need to do. What other challenges have you experienced over the last 10 plus years that you know, have helped you to continue to persist and grow?
I don't know why this actually popped into my head when you thought that, but so this is actually more of kind of a almost like a moral dilemma. So thankfully now I've niched down and focused. So that's one thing that I would recommend to any entrepreneur is not necessarily super niche focus, but have a focus. Moving around a whole lot makes it harder for you to grow because you're doing so many things. But when I started out in law, we say I was practicing door law. Basically anything that came to the door is I would handle. And so I had a client that was pretty regular and mainly business stuff, but then I also would handle small litigation matters for him. And yeah, he just was not a very ethical person, not like extremely immoral, but just there were things that I kind of just started to be like, you know, I can't do that. So there's one time, for instance, that I ended up saving him about 90 grand that he should have owed, but due to just the letter of the law, he didn't actually owe it. But I'm like, you know that you should pay that person. And so that happened. There was another time. And so that was the first thing where I was like, oh, this doesn't feel right. But technically the law is there, but didn't feel right. And then there's another time where it was a carpet company. It's like a mom and pop carpet company. And this client owned a hotel and the person had redone like a floor of the carpet or something like that. And my client still owed them, I don't know, like 30, 50 grand, something like that. And he was like, their attorney like reached out to me and said, hey, can, you know, we get this settled? Can they pay? It's an outstanding invoice. And so I tell my client, and my client was like, tell him we'll give him $10,000. And I'm like, why? He's like, just because that's all I want to give to him. And I was just like, but I'm looking at the contract here and it says you owe and you paid part of it and you haven't paid all of it. And he's like, yeah, just tell him I'll give $10,000. That's all I'm going to give, or he can sue me. And he basically knew that the guy really couldn't afford to sue him. And so he just kind of took advantage of him like that. And so that's when I actually had to fire that client. And even though I needed that client, but I was just like, yeah, you know, I can't do that. Because, you know, I was trying to picture myself, you know, what if I'm that small business and somebody's doing that same thing? Because if somebody owed me at that time, somebody owed me money, I wouldn't have had the war chest to sue them either. And so things like that, you know, it was hard because I was still struggling. That was still at a time where I'm checking the mailbox for rent and like just making it, and cutting off this client that is a regular money that I was getting in was tough. But that's one of the things that, you know, I'm happy about, that I, you know, didn't quote unquote sell my soul. Some people do. I'd say just know what your prices or what your limits are, because there might be those times where you're pressured or tested to do things that may not jive with what your personal ethos is.
Definitely. No, I'm glad you mentioned that. In your experience, have you seen just generally like a lot of people who will do stuff like that just because they know, like try to give somebody a crumbs because they know they wouldn't be able to face them in court, like they wouldn't be able to last through the whole litigation process and stuff?
It's definitely out there for sure. Or even sometimes it's just, oh, you want to sue? Great. I'm going to make this very expensive for you so that you just can't win. Because, yeah, I don't litigate it now. Yeah. But a lot of times litigation is just a war of attrition. Who has the war chest to fight it long enough to stay and last versus who is kind of getting edgy and just ready to get rid of it and wants to settle now?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned also doing what you said, door law. Right. Yeah. So at what point did you choose a focus, and was that focus always real estate, or how did you figure out, all right, this is going to be what my firm focuses on?
So the focus always was business and real estate. Yeah. Actually, in law school, it's weird because I really enjoy the topic of law. Mm-hmm. But after the first year, that's the hard year. And I got through it, did pretty well. But I was just like, I don't really know that I want to, like, I don't want to be in court every day and doing that stuff. But I also was like, I've already finished the first year, which is the hard year. I've got on all this debt. So I got to make something out of this. But thankfully, I took a class called Entrepreneurship in the Law. And so it's talking about the legal aspects of, you know, businesses and, you know, the security stuff I talked about and that sort of stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's the stuff I want to be doing. So after the first year, I focused on business and real estate classes, and then just dove in at when I graduated and had all that time, was just reading all the practice guides, all the treatises, all the books to just really learn that stuff. So that was always the focus. But when you're starting out, you know, you can have your focus, but if somebody says, hey, I need this, and I was like, yeah, I can figure that out. So you know, at the time, I was like, I just had to do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, business and real estate had always been the focus. And I'd say probably maybe after about 3 or 4 years, I was really able to kind of hone in on that more, just because I had a bit more of clients to where I can now focus on the area I wanted to versus trying to take whatever I can to scrape rent and meals together kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So how did you build your client base over time in the business and real estate focus? Like how did you do that? And the reason I'm asking that is because maybe we have somebody in law school or somebody who's just getting out who loves real estate and wants to focus on that in their career. So how did you end up building your client base?
So yeah, that's a cool question, I think, because when I'm looking at it now, I'm like, man, it actually works. So funny thing. So when I first opened launched the website, and again, I had never really run a business before. And so I had the website up and I'm just like, why is nobody calling me? It's like, well, yeah, you got to market. And so then when I kind of realized that, I was like, you know, I want to have a firm that I could work at it from anywhere in the world, anywhere I have internet, and that the clients just call, and like I have referrals and stuff. And so even still to this day, I spent maybe $200 back like in 2010 when I first launched the website. I got a $100 Google ad credit and $100 Facebook credit. Outside of that, it's just been word of mouth. So, you know, I do speak at a lot of conferences and things like that now. And so that's how I'm able to meet people. But it has been all referral based. And so I think the cool thing about that now is that, you know, when I started out and when I said that, you know, there was a goal, as a dream, but I don't think I really thought it could actually happen at the time. But now I'm like, man, I have like a pretty large client base and we don't advertise. And I'm not against advertising, but right now we haven't had to, and it keeps growing. So, with that, I would say one is just relationships. And even that's actually our motto, relationships first. So throughout my life, the successes that I've had have always been with relationships. You know, that friend where I was doing the tax consulting, that's a law school friend that I was really close with. Relationship fed me for my first year out of law school. The friend that introduced me to her boss that gave me my first client, again, relationship got me my first client. And so I really do, you know, value relationship a lot. And when I started, I was like, you know what? I want to get clients that know that I care about them, know that they're not just a number, but that I actually am looking out for their interests and wanting their business to grow and wanting to grow with them. And so I think that's something that has just resonated well mm-hmm. with clients, in that, you know, they do feel like they're not a number. And it was funny, even I think it was probably yesterday or the day before, I had a new potential client that had just come to our website from social media or something. And I pop on the Zoom because I typically do just like a free to talk about our process, our pricing, that sort of stuff. And I pop on, I'm like, hello. She's like, oh, it's you. I was like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? She's like, oh, well, I wasn't expecting you to be there. I was like, well, yeah, you know, if you're going to work with us, I want to know who we're working with. But yeah, so I think relationships has really taken me very far in business and just life in general, too.
Definitely. I love that. And I think so often people focus on just like getting the money. You know, I want your money from you for the service, and that's it. Like, that's it. There's no mm-hmm. relationship. There's no connection. There's no care. And I think I like that you shared that, because it goes a long way. It really does. And, you know, why wouldn't somebody want to work with somebody who would affirm, who cares about them, as actually invested in seeing them succeed, and not just like, you need me for this document or to push this deal through. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I would assume that has brought you repeat clients. You know, I'm sure that's part of what has gotten you referrals and things of that nature. So I think, you know, especially even at a broader scale, like in the real estate world in general, like, it's all relationships. It really is. And so I think it's important for people to know and understand that, and not be so transactional. Like, there's a tendency for people to be so transactional. Mm-hmm. You're just thinking about the transaction. You're just thinking about the money. But what about the person? Like, you're dealing with a human.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're dealing with a person who has emotions, who has things they care about, who has a life outside of what y'all are working on. So I think it's important. I mean, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. And like a cool example of that actually is, so that friend who referred me to her boss that was a property manager, we became also friends. And then as she started investing in her own real estate, I would handle like their one, you know, single units or fourplexes. And now that friend is actually, she's actually the one who got me deeper into doing syndication. Mm-hmm. And now she's buying $100 million, $130 million, 400 plus unit buildings.
Wow.
And it's been cool. And that's one of multiple stories I have like that, to where I have a client that was kind of starting out when I was starting out. And now I'm seeing them like grow like crazy, further than any of us ever would have thought that they would, or at least me. And not that I'm limiting them at all, but
yeah.
I would have never imagined anybody that I knew was going to be doing things like that. So,
yeah.
And have other clients in similar things, to where we start out when they were kind of new, and then now they're just doing crazy big things. So that's been super rewarding for sure.
Definitely. I would like to talk about expansion, because now you have things at 4 or 5 employees. So talk about that part, you know, because I'm assuming prior to that, you're doing a lot of stuff of your own, maybe contracting out things here and there. But talk about that, and just like now having to manage, or working towards like managing multiple people, and just, you know, like you said, making sure they eat and they can pay their bills and things like that. Talk about that transition.
Yeah, I'm like really loving that right now, because I'm kind of in that. And it's probably it happened in probably around 2019, 2020, because mm-hmm. I started realizing, I was like, because I would say I had a business, and I technically did, but really I owned a job, because I was doing everything. I think I might have had a part-time paralegal or something, but I was doing everything. And so if a client needs something, I'm doing everything. And so the business that I owned was running me instead of me running the business. Mm. And I got to a point where, you know, I'd be busy. And I'd be like, man, I wish I had some help. But I'm like, it would take me longer to teach them for them to help me. Then, so I'm just going to do it now. And I kept doing that. And I was like, this pattern can't keep repeating. And so then I started really kind of focusing on getting into like just even learning the process, but then also getting into building out systems and processes, so that now when I need that help, I can at least have a little bit of a playbook, to where I'm not having to train them and do everything. And so it's still hard for me. I'll say right now, I'm learning, and my wife will already agree, I'm a bit of a control freak, particularly because I had the firm, you know, the first decade was basically just me. And so now delegating stuff to my staff, and every time that I do it, they're fine and they do it great, but I'm still always just so hesitant because I'm like, it's me, I gotta do it. And I just gotta, so that's one thing that I'm working on, is learning that I'm not as great as I think I am, and my staff's awesome, and I gotta let them do more. But it's been really fun. I feel like I'm getting back to like my entrepreneurial desire and roots and quest, because now I'm like, okay, now how can I make this business better? Whereas before it was like, okay, let me get this document done for the client, or let me get this thing done. Now I'm actually kind of building something that's much bigger than even just me. And it's been really cool. And it's cool, scary, kind of weird. There'll be some times where, because I have an associate attorney now too. And so there'll be some times where like a document goes out, or like a LLC is formed and the operating agreement is done. And I'm like, wait, who is it? Who did that? What's going on here? Because before I was touching on every single thing. So this, I'm really enjoying it right now, like growing the business, because I get to get back to like just focusing. And I'm still doing the law a bit as well, but I get to focus on, you know, creative ways to what's the client experience like? How can I make that better? What are my employees experiencing? How can I make it easier for them to do their work? What are some ways that I can allow us to do our work more efficiently so we can charge the same price, but we're actually, our margin's going to be higher? Mm-hmm. That type of stuff is a lot of fun to me.
Definitely. Definitely. It's going to help you grow, man. It's going to help you grow. I mean, I can only imagine like 10 years and then now you kind of have to let go. And I mean, cause think about it, right? You know, if you think back to the days when you were looking in the mailbox several times a day for that check, like I'm sure you wanted to make sure every T was crossed, every I was dotted, cause like your life is on the line to some degree. So I can imagine like growing and scaling, and you know, now you're entrusting somebody else with something that's so incredibly important. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know what I'm saying?
It's my baby.
So you, exactly. So you can continue to keep eating. But I mean, it's good. I think I'm glad you're leaning into it, and you know, it's going to help you grow. It's going to help you scale, man. What's the office setup? Are y'all remote, hybrid, in office? What's the setup like? I'm just curious. It's 2023. I got to ask that.
Yeah, I was remote before it was cool to be remote. Yeah. So like I said before, you know, I early on, I was like, I wish I could have a firm where I can work on it from anywhere in the world. So I kind of had that in my mind even before it's really a thing. Mm-hmm. I remember even like co-working spaces were new. Like there was like four or five of them in LA.
Yeah.
And there's been times where I had an office, and every time I had it, I might meet a client there once a month, or I'd be driving there just because I'm like, I'm paying for this. Mm-hmm. And so I probably haven't had a physical office probably at least 6 or 7 years. Wow. Just because I never actually needed it. Now, as we're growing, I do see that in the future there could be a place to have a bit of a physical presence. But yeah, right now we're all remote and still doing a lot of good work.
That's awesome. Is your team mostly based here, or are they kind of different places?
They started out based here, but then they get remote world. Yeah, they're all in California, but not super local to where I'm at.
Got you. That's dope. Do y'all ever get together in person?
Yeah, we have quarterly firm skip days. So we'll do like we'll do a Top Golf or escape room or something like that.
Yeah.
Cause yeah, that's one thing, again, going back to like the fun entrepreneurship stuff. I actually was talking with one of my friends with her company, and she's also remote. And so we're kind of talking about ways of how we can still keep morale high, keep people like connected, even though we're not in the office seeing each other every single day.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, man. Something that just popped in my head that I meant to ask earlier, we spoke very briefly, but about guaranteeing returns.
Oh, yeah.
And so we just spoke about it yesterday. So talk to me about your thoughts on people guaranteeing returns.
Run away. that's what I can say. Like we've been saying this whole time, right? Things can go bad. Even the, like I said, my clients that are buying $100 million buildings, they still have things that go wrong sometimes. So there's nothing that's ever going to be absolutely guaranteed. And if somebody is saying absolute, like the only way you can really guarantee that, and even then it's still not even guaranteed, but like a Ponzi scheme would be really the only way you can guarantee. And you don't want to invest in a Ponzi scheme. So yeah, if somebody is guaranteeing something, I am not investing in that. Now, when clients try to say, we're going to guarantee this, and I say, no, we're going to project this. That's different. If they're projecting returns, yeah, I want to know what you project. I want to know where you think I'm going to land if I invest with you. But if you're telling me I am guaranteed, unless you're like, I don't know, the only way I could almost think that I might invest in something guaranteed is if like you're putting your own personal home up as collateral, because most people are going to work real hard to keep their own home. But yeah, investments are not guaranteed. They are risky. And that's kind of why we've been having this conversation, is that they indeed are risky. The most seasoned person is going to make mistakes. The greenest person is going to make mistakes. The most seasoned person can have losses on their investments. The new person can have losses on their investments. So nothing's guaranteed. And if somebody's telling you that, I'm like giving you the real, real side eye and probably just running away, because yeah, things are not guaranteed with investments.
Yeah, no, that's real. That's real. I think just run.
I mean, we've seen, you know, was it Silicon Valley Bank? Like, man, banks that you were thinking of, bank, my money's at a bank is guaranteed. That actually affected me. My payroll processor used Silicon Valley Bank. So I get a call, like I landed, and I check my voicemail, and it's like, it's my CPA telling me, hey, we got an email and your payroll's not going to go through. So I had to like, wire from the phone, I'm getting on the plane, wire extra money to make sure my payroll got there. But yeah, a bank is failing with hundreds of millions of dollars. So what makes you think that somebody who's doing a $100,000 project is guaranteed?
Wow. How did that work out with Silicon Valley Bank?
Thankfully, it wasn't actually my money there. My payroll processor used them. So the money I had sent to them for them to send payroll, they're like, yeah, we don't have access to that right now. So, it ended up being fine. I ended up getting the money back in like a week or two.
Gotcha. That was crazy. That was a crazy situation, man.
Yeah.
Man, this has been such a good interview. I think what I appreciate most is just like the directness, quite frankly, and just like really helping people to understand, you know, what paperwork is needed for different type of deals, like what type of questions they should be asking to the person who is presenting information and opportunities to them. So I think that was great. And then also hearing your story too, right? That's part of this as well. Just hearing your story of starting your business and getting to your focus of real estate and business. And I mean, hey, we might have a lawyer watching. My sister, she graduated law school last year. Nice. So I know she's going to watch. I know she's going to watch this and check this one out. She wants to do a lot of things, similar things that you've done. I'm sure there's people out there who are going to learn a whole lot from your expertise and what you shared. And I think this was very special because we've never had a lawyer on the show. Cool. And so I think this is timely and important, man. So I really, really appreciate it. And, you know, proud of everything that you're doing and you know, sticking it out in business. I know it'll be inspiration to a lot of people out there.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Definitely. Definitely. So, Nick, let everybody know where they can find you and just any last words, anything you may want to share with the listeners.
Okay. Yeah. So the firm is Polymath Legal. So you can find me at polymathlegal.com, PolyMathLegal.com. Or on social media, I'm at Nick the Lawyer. That's NIC the Lawyer. Nick has no K. So Nick the Lawyer. And yeah, you get all my contact information on the website or the link in my social bios as well. Yeah, I'd say keep listening to Sam and the Black Real Estate Dialogues. We talked about, you know, the risk of investing and not jumping in. Part of the way you can mitigate that is hearing other people's stories and getting educated. So working with, dealing with somebody like Sam, you're in a great spot. And yeah.
Appreciate that, man. Appreciate that. And thank you to everyone for listening to another episode. Really appreciate it. If you haven't already, if you're on YouTube, make sure you subscribe, make sure you like and share this video with someone who could find it valuable. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us a 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.